Major League Baseball umpires' responsibilities include officiating the game and safeguarding those on the field. Their duties include enforcing rules, making judgment calls on plays, evaluating field conditions, equipment use, and potential weather hazards. But for all this work to maintain a safe and fair game, umpires are often maligned and their actions berated. I'm your host, Nina Instead, and you're listening to Dead Ball. For baseball fans, opening day is what gets us through frosty and biting winters, through freezing mounds of snow, and the hopeless thought of never feeling warm again. As John Fogerty's love song to baseball, Center Field, says, "Well, beat the drum and hold the phone. The sun came out today. We're born again. There's new grass on the field." The imagery of the brown-eyed handsome man rounding third and headed for home has all the plot of a romance story. Well, a romance about baseball, anyway. On one particular opening day, the festivities stopped about as soon as they began, and the ending was anything but a storybook one. In the top of the first inning, home plate umpire John McSherry stood straight up, turned toward the backstop, took a few steps, and collapsed from a massive heart attack. McSherry was pronounced dead later in the day. It was April 1st, 1996, in Cincinnati, home to the first professional baseball team, the Reds. Opening day in Cincinnati is not simply a baseball game. It is a happening of the first order. Attending a Reds opening day game is something to brag about to friends and colleagues. The opening day parade winds its way through downtown Cincinnati, filled with Reds dignitaries, politicians, local businesses, and anyone else who can finagle a spot in the celebratory procession. Restaurants and bars open early, and beer flows as if a dam busted. For this medium place of Cincinnati, pound for pound, the city puts on the best party you'll ever see. And Reds fans had a lot to be excited about in 1996. The previous year, Cincinnati won the National League Central and the National League Division Series in three straight games against their rivals, the LA Dodgers. The Reds, however, would be defeated in the National League Championship Series in four games to the eventual World Series champion Atlanta Braves. New Reds manager Ray Knight was looking to keep the momentum going of last season. Opening day, 1996, was his first game as Cincinnati Reds manager. It's hard to imagine a much worse first day on the job than what Knight experienced. Ray Knight was drafted by the Cincinnati Reds in the 10th round of the 1970 MLB June Amateur Draft. He played 13 seasons in the major leagues, beginning in 1974 with the Reds, until being traded to the Houston Astros in 1982, and on to the Mets and Orioles before wrapping up his career in 1989 after a year with the Tigers. Knight appeared in the 1980 and 1982 All-Star Games and a member of the 1986 World Champion New York Mets. Knight finished his career with a .271 batting average, an on-base percentage of .321, and a slugging average of .390. For Montreal Expos fans, the joy of a new season was not because of any success in the previous year, but with hopes of washing away the bad taste of 1995. The Expos finished their season in last place, 24 games behind, with a 66-78 record. The team of the 80s, as they were called just a decade earlier, no longer packed the punch of a once strong and formidable franchise. 50,000 people filed into Riverfront Stadium on April 1st, and the temperature was brisk, in the upper 40s, not quite baseball weather. Fans wore coats and scarves and brought blankets to keep warm. There were four college kids in the nosebleed sections without shirts. They had Reds, R-E-D-S, respectively painted on their chests, further evidence that the human brain doesn't fully develop until age 25. Reds left-hander Pete Shurick was on the mound, having already faced two Expos batters, Mark Grudzielanek, who flied out to right field, and then Mike Lansing, who struck out swinging. The next batter was center fielder Rondell White. Reds catcher Eddie Taubensee would tell the Cincinnati Inquirer, "McSherry just said, 'Hold on, time out for a second.' I turned around and said, 'Are you all right, John?' He didn't say anything. I thought maybe he pulled something by the way he was walking." McSherry stood straight up from his crouching position. He motioned to the second base umpire for help, turned to walk toward the home plate door, and collapsed. Field officials as well as team trainers from both the Reds and Expos rushed to McSherry. He was taken to the University of Cincinnati Hospital with his friend and third base umpire Tom Hallion by his side. Emergency doctors used intravenous drugs and cardioversion to revive him, but McSherry's heart was just too weak from the attack, and he was pronounced dead around 3 p.m. Back at Synergy Field, the other two umpires, Steve Ripley and Jerry Crawford, they were left to sort out what to do with an opening day game that was 7 pitches old. At first, the remaining umpires were set to resume the game. Jerry Crawford spoke with Ray Knight, saying that he planned to continue the game with he and Steve Ripley only. But when Knight entered the Reds' locker room, he heard from his players and saw on their faces that they were in no emotional state to play. Shortstop and future Hall of Famer Barry Larkin said to Knight, "Ray, I've had a lot of deaths in my family. In good conscience, out of respect for life, I can't go out there." Barry Larkin, along with Reds center fielder Eric Davis, visited the umpires' locker room to talk with Ripley and Crawford, offering what consoling words they could. It was obvious that everyone was deeply affected. After all, they had just witnessed a man collapse and die right in front of them. And while we all love the game, sometimes we must understand that it is, in fact, just a game. Eric Davis told Tim Sullivan of the Cincinnati Inquirer, "Players and umpires are at each other's throats all the time, but unity is more important now than balls and strikes. This is a situation we're in together." Cincinnati starting pitcher Pete Shurick said, "It would have been extremely hard. I was kind of torn between what was right and what was wrong. If the umpires wanted to go out in his honor, I was ready to go back out there. But I thought they made the right decision." He went on to say, "I watched a man die today. It hits home in a hurry." But listeners, not everyone was sympathetic. Reds owner Marge Schott, who was a great embarrassment and albatross of the Reds organization, said to radio station 700 WLW, "Snow this morning and now this. I don't believe it. I feel cheated. This isn't supposed to happen to us. Not in Cincinnati. This is our history, our tradition, our team. Nobody feels worse than me." Schott later apologized by sending the umpiring crew flowers, but in pure Schott fashion, even that did not come without turmoil. The Dayton Daily News reported the flowers she sent were given to her by a television station covering the Reds. Now, John McSherry was about as universally loved as an umpire could be. Reds Hall of Fame announcer Marty Brenneman told Cincinnati CBS affiliate WCPO, "I don't know that there's an umpire who has more respect in our league, and I would think in baseball, than John McSherry does. And the proof of that is the fact that very rarely would you ever see him involved in any type of verbal altercation on the field with any player or coach." The following day, the Reds and Expos played the delayed game in front of a crowd just as big as the day before. Prior to the game was a prayer and a moment of silence for John McSherry. And in possibly the first time in the game of baseball, the umpiring crew received a standing ovation as they came through the umpire door, located behind home plate and onto the field. John McSherry began his career in the Carolina League in 1967 and 1968 and moved to the International League from 1969 to May of 1971 when he was called up to the majors. McSherry umpired in the National League from June 1971 until his death. He worked more than 3,000 games. Career highlights included working the National League Championship Series 8 times, the World Series 2 in 1977 and 1987, and All-Star Games of 1975, 1982, and 1991. If there was ever a pitcher-friendly umpire behind the plate of a major league game, it was Eric Gregg. Coming to the plate, hitters knew they'd need to step outside of their comfort zone and swing at pitches they normally would lay off. To call his swollen strike zone generous would be like calling Miguel Cabrera an average hitter. This was the challenge that every batter had to face, but to Gregg's credit, more often than not, the strike zone was the same for both teams. The man was at least fair in his disregard for a true strike zone. Gregg called his first game in 1975 and became a member of the National League staff in 1978. He worked the 1989 World Series, 4 championship series, 2 divisional series, and 1 All-Star game. An example of his oversized strike zone was never more obvious than in Game 5 of the 1997 National League Championship Series, where the Atlanta Braves faced the Florida Marlins. Florida's Levan Hernandez struck out 15 batters, and the Braves' Greg Maddux sat down 9 as the teams combined to set a championship series record with 25 strikeouts. The Marlins won that game 2-1, and that was Greg's last postseason appearance as an umpire. Gregg was a trailblazer for African Americans in the umpiring profession. He was the 3rd African American umpire in the major leagues after Emmett Ashford and Art Williams. Out of the 76 full-time umpires in Major League Baseball, 6 are African American, which works out to just under 8%. So representation, even in 2022, is still lower than 1 in 10. On his right wrist, Gregg wore a silver bracelet engraved with the words, "Big John, number 10. He said in an interview to the Philadelphia City Paper, "It's a testament to my best friend, Big John McSherry." In 1996, shortly after McSherry died from his heart attack, Gregg entered a weight loss program at Duke University. He lost 100 pounds from his former size of nearly 4 times that. This West Philadelphia-born and raised man came a long way from 44th and Haverford, the tough West Philly neighborhood where he grew up. A long way away from where his brother was imprisoned, where his sister died of a drug overdose, and where a baseball coach told Gregg he would never be good enough to excel in the game. In an interview with ESPN, his son, Kevin Gregg, talked about how his father felt as a high school catcher when a coach told him he was too overweight to play baseball and that he was never going to be good enough. Quote, "He had the mentality of, damn that, I'm still going to be involved." Eric Gregg saw a television commercial for an umpiring school and knew this could be his shot to get back to the game he loved so much. So who says television is bad for you? In total, Gregg umpired for 23 years, 2,622 games, 647 of those behind the plate, where he was most well known. Gregg ejected 81 men during his tenure, including some of the biggest names in baseball, Tommy Lasorda, Joe Torre, Tony La Russa, and Johnny Bench. A remarkable fact about his ejections, in only 2 games of his career did Gregg eject players for fighting. Both games were between the Reds and the Mets. The first, July 22, 1986, he ran Eric Davis and Mario Soto from the Reds along with Ray Knight and Kevin Mitchell of the Mets, both of whom would become future Reds themselves. The second game was April 30th, 1988, where he ejected Tom Browning of the Reds and Daryl Strawberry from the Mets. No love for the Big Apple or the Queen City, I guess. But even with Eric Gregg's generous strike zone and a more than 2-decade career, he is most known for his role in the 1999 Major League Baseball umpire strike. Now, the exact occurrence of what was the gasoline on the fire to get Major League Baseball to an umpire strike isn't exactly known. It may have been the pressure felt by the men in blue of being more and more disrespected. And while umpires may have been right in their actions, they forgot the most important part of negotiation, leverage. And the umpires of Major League Baseball had almost none. Go to any Little League game in America, and more than likely you will witness an angry parent or coach bawling out an umpire. To the casual observer, it almost feels like as much a part of the game as batting gloves or sunflower seeds. And I don't know if the disrespect of officials is as bad in all sports, but it just seems magnified in baseball. But everyone notices, and little is done about it. The argument can be made that Major League umpires are paid handsomely for their time and should be able to take a little more razzing than a knothole game umpire earning $20 for their time and relying on mom to pick them up afterwards. But listeners, the issue goes beyond that. Any sport relies on a level of respect and trust for third-party, unbiased officials. If we don't have that, we don't have a game. During the 1990s, umpires began feeling a new level of disrespect from players, coaches, and even fans. They still had the final say with their calls, but the umps were increasingly annoyed by an escalating level of hostility from players arguing calls. Suspensions and fines of players and coaches were often lessened by the powerful players' union. On September 27, 1996, a legendary kerfluffle went down between Baltimore second baseman Roberto Alomar and home plate umpire John Hirschbeck about a called third strike. The bases were empty with one out and a 3-2 count on Alomar. The payoff pitch was so outside, it may have caught enough of the plate for a breadcrumb to balance on, but it was no more than that, and Alomar was not pleased with the call. The men jawed back and forth for a few moments, and Alomar returned to the dugout. Third baseman Todd Zeile came to the plate for his appearance, and everything looked okay, but Alomar continued to belabor the point loudly, and Hirschbeck ejected him. Alomar sprinted from the dugout along with manager Davey Johnson, who did his best to keep his all-star from making matters worse, but it was too late. In the first few seconds, Alomar spit in Hirschbeck's face, taking the matter to an unneeded level. Alomar later said he spit on Hirschbeck when the home plate umpire used racial insults, particularly one about Alomar's mother. Hirschbeck denied the accusation, saying that if he used any vulgar language, it was after he was spit on, not before. Davey Johnson never revealed what he heard, only saying, "I think they're both guilty." In late June, an already volatile atmosphere went further south with another player-umpire altercation, resulting in the unprecedented suspension of umpire Tom Hellion after allegedly bumping several members of the Colorado Rockies during a game in June. The Major League Umpires Association had had enough. As Michael, channeling William Shakespeare, says to Cameron in 10 Things I Hate About You, "The shit hath hitteth the fanneth." The umpire union's leader, Richie Phillips, was seen by the MLB front office as well as players and coaches as a hothead and a bully susceptible to temper tantrums, so Major League Baseball lost no sleep over it. Phillips had taken over as head of the union in 1978 and immediately began a hostile relationship with baseball management. Under Phillips, the umpires stopped work in 78, 79, 84, and 95. Phillips was a blunt and in-your-face kind of speaker. There was no sugarcoating what came out of his mouth. Meanwhile, umpires are fed up with the slaps on the wrist given to players arguing calls and being physical on the field. Phillips demanded that unless baseball did something about it, 57 of his 66 unionized umpires would quit on September 2nd. Phillips knew that this threat had only a chance of working if he had the moxie to go through with it. MLB brass were not blinking. Executive Vice President Sandy Alderson, who was known as a shrewd businessman, made baseball positions clear as Waterford Crystal, saying about Phillips' warning, "It's a threat to be ignored or an offer to be accepted." Alderson called the bluff. He knew that no one comes to a ball game clamoring to see the umpires. Fans pay to see Pedro Martinez, Derek Jeter, and Craig Biggio. He also believed strike zones had become subjective and almost completely different from one umpire to the next. Perhaps a fresh dose of umpires from the minor leagues could do a better job. If the umpires wanted to quit, Alderson would hold the door for them to leave. Panic set in at Phillips' office. His phone was ringing off the hook. Umpires desperately tried to rescind their resignations, but the MLB did not back down. They told Phillips' office, "We've ordered up the replacements, and this time they're not temps." Phillips took this matter to court to win the umpires their jobs back. The judge sided with Major League Baseball, stating that since the umpires quit, they were no longer provided job protection. Umpires who jumped ship from Phillips early on returned to the game eventually. 35 of the 57 umpires got their jobs back. But for the other 22 umpires who stuck by Phillips, they were persona non grata. And one of those men was Eric Gregg. There was a group of umpires later rehired by court order, but again, Gregg was left out in the cold. It would be 2004 before Gregg would see a favorable court decision. He was granted $400,000 in back pay when an agreement was reached to settle the issue. In the years following, Gregg operated a bar at Philadelphia's Veterans Stadium and later Citizens Bank Park. He also served as referee at 610 WIP's annual Wing Bowl. Gregg may have been controversial in some aspects of his umpiring approach, but he was a giant in his field, and because he listened to bad advice from a man too clever for his own good, Gregg was robbed of his dream job. June 4th, 2006. Gregg tells family members during the morning at his home in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, that he can't feel anything on his left side. He was hospitalized and died at 6:45 p.m., Monday. In an interview with ESPN, umpire Jerry Crawford said, "He was my friend, and I'll miss him. He was a very good umpire. He loved the game. He was a funny guy. He had a great time at it. He was a terrific partner. He loved his kids, and I loved the guy." Thank you for listening to this episode of Deadball, which was written by Thad Scott. For more information about the podcast or to connect with like-minded baseball fans, check out the Dead Ball podcast group on Facebook.